Salo Falava. I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Malo alele, fatalo fatu, nisan bulivinaka, but most importantly, hello and welcome to Pacific Beats on ABC Radio Australia, where we're streaming live to you in Papua New Guinea as it celebrates its 50th anniversary of independence. Nimbilong Miemi Egi Tupo, host of Pacific Beat. But we're fortunate enough to have our reporter on the ground here in PNG joining us to co-host throughout this significant week. It's Belinda Kaur of that. Belinda, so good to be here in your homeland. You step all right?
Thank you, Aggie. Yes, me all right. Now, even more excited to have you here in the country to also celebrate this important event with our listeners in Papua New Guinea.
Yeah, thank you, Belinda. Look, it's going to be a great week of celebrations and stories from the last 50 years of PNG, where we'll be live again from Port Moresby every day this week. Now, we'll have more on all our stories coming up very shortly, but as always, I say thank you to us for joining our special edition of Pacific Beat in Port Moresby, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, Papua New Guinea's capital is awash in black, red and yellow as the country prepares to celebrate its golden jubilee of independence. The 50-year milestone is being marked at events across the city as dignitaries from around the region and the world arrive ahead of Independence Day tomorrow. Pride and excitement are the overwhelming feelings among locals, but there's also some soul-searching about the country's progress. Liam Fox reports.
The party is well and truly underway in Port Moresby. PNG flags are flying everywhere you look, and the vast majority of people are dressed in the national colours of black, red and yellow. A variety of events across the city celebrate the country's rich and varied cultures. At the Pusin Tumbuna Festival at the city's nature park, people from other provinces are sharing their local traditions.
So this is the base.
So the chicken straight onto the stones.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Patricia Memele, a Tolai woman from East New Britain, is making aigia, chicken, greens and coconut milk cooked on hot stones.
I am excited. A lot of change has come, and we kind of moved away from how we did things back then in the day. I mean, that's growth. I am a proud East New Briton, and I'm a proud Papua New Guinean.
Nearby, fellow Tolai, Eunice Oliver, is making strands of traditional shell money. She was in primary school in 1975 and says there's been a lot of changes, many for the better, but she has mixed feelings about the state of the country.
When I go back to the village, I don't see the services really come down to the village level, so that's a sad thing.
Over at Parliament House, people have flown in from around the country to showcase PNG's incredible flora at the National Orchid Show. PNG has more species of orchid than anywhere else in the world, and the kaleidoscopic array on display is as diverse and colourful as the country's different cultures. Trimming a bunch of everlasting flowers, Betty Wyme has come from Goroka in the Eastern Highlands.
It's very important to us as mothers because we love growing flowers, but we never know that it would someday bring us this far. It's part of our income and it helps us a lot.
For her, the Golden Jubilee is about gratitude.
In a feeling of freedom, we can remember our fathers that have come before us and fight to give us this freedom that we can celebrate. It's a part of, what can I say, thank you.
It's not just Papua New Guineans celebrating. Dignitaries have flown in from around the region and the world to join in. The most high-profile visitor is the Duke of Edinburgh, Prince Edward, who flew in yesterday afternoon to represent his brother, King Charles III, and the British people. Australia's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese arrives later today, along with his ministers for Defence and the Pacific. He'll join in the commemorations and possibly sign a major security agreement while he's here.
And that's Liam Fox reporting.
Pacific Beat.
In the eyes of many Papua New Guineans, something even bigger than independence happened in 1975, because in what was a landmark year for the country's national sport of rugby league, the PNG Kumus played their first ever international match. Now, half a century later, PNG has thriving national competitions for men and women, a national women's team that has been established, and the PNG Hunters are firmly entrenched in the Queensland Cup competition. And on top of that, as Richard Ewart reports, the biggest prize of all is within PNG's grasp as they prepare to take their place in Australia's National Rugby League competition in 2028.
2 months before it became an independent nation, Papua New Guinea had already made a very clear statement about the country's pending arrival on the global stage, as perhaps only PNG could. Rugby league writer and author Patrick Skeen says it was in July that year that the Kumuls played their first international match against England in front of 12,000 supporters in Port Moresby.
The captain, Kumul number one, Paul Chue, was actually a Chinese Papua New Guinean from Rabaul, but most of the players were either Highlanders or New Guinea Islanders coming together. And I think that team was the real first time we got to see the new proud post-independence Papua New Guinea.
By 1975, rugby league was already entrenched in PNG's DNA, with integrated competitions established in the 1960s. And sometimes enthusiasm for the game boiled over.
They had their own state of origin every year, which actually got to fever pitch. So it was Papua versus New Guinea. And they were so crazy for that in 1974, there was a riot after their version of State of Origin, and it was never played again. So it was already at packed house, fanatical level, and the first Kumuls team just walked into that very warm atmosphere.
And over the years since, the Kumuls have channeled that fanaticism, and they've had some notable wins. But while they've had their moments, they're yet to conquer Australia.
August Joseph.
Now, though, PNG is on the brink of the biggest event in their national sports history, the arrival of a Papua New Guinea team in the NRL. And on the sports fields in Port Moresby, there is no shortage of young players who want to be part of it.
The boys are, training hard and trying their best, because there's a pathway created by the NRL.
With the 19th team in the NRL, rugby league can help a lot of youths here.
In PNG, there are many sickness, and rugby can fight against it, so it's important.
Some of us, life is hard, and our dream is to play rugby in the NRL.
It was PNG's founding father, Sir Michael Somare, who actually started the campaign for a PNG NRL team back in 2008, when he committed some $7 million to the process. However, the big push began in 2019 under Prime Minister James Marape, which culminated last year in the $600 million deal signed by the Australian government, with just under half that money set aside to fund a PNG NRL franchise during its first 10 years. But former national men's coach and now Governor of East New Britain Michael Marram says there's still plenty of work to be done in preparation for the big kickoff in 2028 if PNG is to get the best out of its homegrown players.
There's a lot of talent around. We're glad that now we have the NRL program that's been rolled out around the country. There's pathway programs for junior age group, boys and girls, right across the country. There's a lot of work to be done. The NRL bid team, they've been going in and out of each province, trying to run awareness campaigns or coaching clinics, making sure we develop not only players, but we identify good coaches, trainers, managers that can be able to contribute to the team long term. Yeah.
Marram was also the inaugural coach of the PNG Hunters, whose arrival in the Queensland Cup in 2014 prompted people to ask, how long will it last? Well, not only did the team prosper, but Marram says it unified the warring factions who had been locked in a court battle for control of PNG's national game.
Oh, definitely, yeah. Hunter sort of brought everyone back into the picture, and when we won that first game against Redcliffe, that sent a signal to all the clubs in Queensland that this Hunter team is not just making up the numbers. We were serious. Eventually, we went on and finished sixth in the competition. Second year, we had 70 wins in a row. That's a record for Queensland Cup. 16 missed out on the finals. 17 was a good year for us.
Boas kicks really good.
Another concern associated with the Hunters was the security of away teams, an issue that's been raised again in connection with the NRL franchise. But Patrick Skeen says the facts speak for themselves.
I did some research and I found out that the PNG Hunters have hosted 102 home games in Papua New Guinea, and there has not been a single reported security incident. And I don't think that's been raised quite seriously when people continue to talk about the security issues, the fact that we've had an unblemished 12-year record.
Part of the NRL plan also includes the establishment of a women's team, and when that happens, Cathy Nyap, who captained the national women's team, the Orchids, in their debut match, says it would be transformative.
I'm leading my team out. It was rugby league, a sport that is known as a male-dominated sport in our country, is now being played by women, and the feeling was just incredible. If PNG do ever enter a women's team, it's going to be mind-blowing. Every young girl would want to play in that team.
The rise of the women's game in PNG has been perhaps the most remarkable rugby league development of the past 50 years.
Rugby league brought us together, single mothers, young girls, girls from different communities and backgrounds, being part of a team, and after game socializing, every time, you know, someone would do a sidestep or a good kick and went and score a try, made us feel good about ourselves, especially girls and women in the settlement areas. It gave them hope and inspiration.
But in the early days, Cathy Nyap and her fellow players had to battle against a wave of misogyny, particularly on social media. And as a result, she says male coaches were just too scared to help them. But victory over England in 2019 went a long way to setting old prejudices aside.
Half of Damien, Shirley Jones, Shirley Jones, Shirley Jones in the open.
So as the country marks its silver jubilee, Patrick Skeen says there is much to look forward to for PNG on the rugby league field.
There's going to be a next generation of PNG players who rise in a very well-organised now Digicel Cup, the domestic competition. They're going to come out of a very well-organised and funded national schools competition, which they don't have now. So all of this infrastructure in place, there's going to be kids growing up that think it's their birthright to play in the NRL. And that sort of confidence is going to breed NRL players who believe from the very beginning of their careers.
So could Michael Marram be tempted back to coaching from the political world? Probably not, but he does have a plan to bring the PNG NRL team to play in his province of East New Britain.
The new Colourbone Stadium, hopefully we'll complete it early next year. And we're putting our hand up that we have a facility now that's built to world standards. So one day, maybe we can see the new franchise come here and play in front of our own people.
Michael Marram, a key figure in the growth of rugby league in Papua New Guinea and now governor of East New Britain province. And the reporter there was Richard Ewart.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
And yes, our Brisbane PNG community had also marked the major milestone of the 50th anniversary of independence with celebrations during the weekend. Now, the event brought together people from across Brisbane and the Pacific in a very colourful showcase of culture and tradition. Among the special guests is Louisa Margaret Udia, crowned the 2025 Heri Haninamo Queen from Tatana Village in Papua New Guinea. She was in Brisbane to take part in the festivities and says preserving custom and culture is key for future generations. Ms. Udia spoke with reporter Leah Lowenbu about her role in the celebration.
It is my first time travelling abroad and I am truly honoured to be here. The days leading up to the event is filled with so much emotions. It's like bringing my Heri spirit to my people here to showcase our culture and to let the people here know that we still uphold our traditions, and we have an important day coming for our country, our 50th independence, and for us to celebrate it here shows that Papua New Guinea still values its culture and traditions. And in doing so and having such events like this, preserves our traditions. And as a proud Motu Koitabuen, our people here, it is so exciting to see the young ones also take part in these events. So we are the future storytellers of our people, and that is why I'm so excited.
Beautiful. So talk a little bit about your participation in the celebration. What part did you play in the celebration?
As the Hiri Hananamu, or the Hiri Queen, for our people, it is my role and responsibility to lead our people, as I do in my role in welcoming delegates or visitors for the event and celebration here, to be part of the cultural group, dancing and singing our traditional songs. So that is something so exciting. They're all happy that I'm here, and so am I. So our people back at home are looking forward to us dancing and singing here as well.
As a young person who is also really passionate about your culture, traditional way of life, what do you think now in 2025, what is the message for young people out there?
My message to the young people out there would be to accept change, but not forget our culture. That is our backbone for our people. It is culture brings us together. It unites our people. So regardless of us living in our country or traveling abroad, culture is what makes us come together. So in us celebrating 50 years, it's showing to other countries that we are still united, and we are so fortunate to have the freedom to express our ideas and also to be proud of how far we have come.
Thank you very much. That is a very, very important point you've mentioned. So what do you think would be different from the celebration here in Brisbane compared to what happens back at home in PNG?
I am truly excited. I've always heard stories about how our people have come and their way of living. It is different from back at home, but seeing how they have welcomed me, starting from the airport, it shows that hospitality and our way of motu and culture is still being held highly here with so much respect and love from our people. So that is something that I will take back home and share it to my people as well.
And that there is Louisa Margaret Udia, PNG 2025 Hiri Haninamo Queen from Tatana Village, speaking with Leia Loanbo.
Every day this week, we'll be listening to the voices of people who helped shape a newly independent Papua New Guinea. They share their experiences of Independence Day, the formation of PNG, and their hopes for the country's future. They were interviewed for the documentary One Country, which was jointly produced by the ABC and NBC and is being broadcast in both countries. First up, we're going to hear from a man who embodies the connection between PNG and Australia, legendary broadcaster Sean Dorney. He started out on loan to the NBC before becoming one of the ABC's longest-serving correspondents in PNG. Oh, and he captained the national men's rugby league team, the Kumuls, as well.
The militants are being terrorised from the Papua New Guinea government.
Storm surges can
be based in Bougainville.
Finding riches.
20 years at the helm.
Sean Dorney in Rabaul.
Sean Dorney on Manus Island.
Sean Dorney, Port Moresby.
I spent three terrific years, actually, up there working for the NBC and ended up playing for the national side for 2 years, and on my last appearance captaining the Kumuls, which was an extraordinary thing for someone who wasn't even a citizen of the country.
And the best thing I ever did in my entire life was meet this one here.
My wife, Pauline, I took an immediate interest in her, which for some time she did not reciprocate. But eventually, I broke her down, and we ended up getting married in 1976. And we've got two kids and now three fabulous grandkids. So it's been a wonderful relationship, and Pauline's been an absolute tower of strength. As a journalist, being there in those years leading up to independence and then immediately after, that was when I was working for the NBC, I just found it to be just an absolutely, you know, bewildering but fascinating and interesting place. There was a real sense of expectation and hope. It was, you know, a very, very exciting time, and I got to travel around, you know, the country with some of the leaders. I got to know Michael Somare and Julius Chan, Yimbaki Okup. I don't think I met one of those significant Papua New Guinean leaders who I didn't like. I, you know, got to know Michael Somare really well. His political party, the Pangu Party, was relatively strong, but when you think of it in Australian terms, the Pangu Party never had more than about one quarter or one fifth of the seat. So putting together governments in Papua New Guinea requires an enormous amount of coordination and urging and talking to other leaders, and putting coalitions together is something that Somare was, you know, a master at.
It was confusing, actually. I don't know whether people really understood just what independence was about. And I think there was a lot of apprehension about the country, you know, this time.
Oh, there was a real reluctance from many of the Highlands provinces to move that rapidly to independence, because the Highlands was opened up, you know, to the outside world much, much later than the coastal areas. The most memorable was covering changes of government. But also, I suppose, you know, some of the big stories that I covered up here involved natural disasters. I got up to cover the volcanic eruption in Rabaul, which was just absolutely extraordinary.
36 hours of violent volcanic activity has left most of Rabaul covered by a thick layer of ash.
The tsunami that hit Itapi, you know, near the border with Irianjaya, was caused enormous devastation. You could see that people who had lost not only lives of their loved ones, but everything else as well, had just been swept away. It's got enormous natural resources, Papua New Guinea, and one of the greatest natural resources it's got, of course, are its people. It is just so diverse. It's just, you know, I think the most interesting place on earth.
Sean Dorney there. He was interviewed for the One Country documentary.
Nation Footy. Hosted by me, Sam Wykes.
And me, Tenero Aruna. Each week, we'll bring you Pacific Islander stories from on and off the rugby league and rugby union field.
We'll have plenty of special guests, tales from the past, tackle the big topics of today, and look forward to the next-gen Nation Footy stars.
Nation Footy. Nation Footy.
Monday afternoons at 4 o'clock PNG time.
On ABC Radio Australia.
The national women's cricket team, the Lewas, are hoping to start Papua New Guinea's Golden Jubilee celebration today early with a win in the final of the East Asia Pacific T20 World Cup qualifier in Suva. Standing in their way are the arch rivals Vanuatu. They are yet to lose in the tournament and won their semi-final over Japan comfortably, while PNG had to battle hard to overcome Indonesia with just three balls to spare. The winner of today's grand final will head to the global qualifier in Nepal in January, where a top four finish would send them through to the T20 World Cup finals in England. So who will be celebrating later today, Vanuatu or PNG? We're joined now by Asinata Vanengolo from the ICC TV commentary team in Suva. Welcome to Pacific Beat, Asinata.
Bolovinaka, thank you very much for welcoming me this morning.
Mbula, and good morning from Port Moresby. Vanuatu are unbeaten, whereas PNG showed they can be vulnerable when losing to Samoa in their final pool match. So does that mean Vanuatu are the favourites today?
Well, Vanuatu have certainly shown their form. They are the defending champions of this tournament, and in the kind of form that their captain is in at the moment, Rachel Andrew, she's been leading them very well. And as you mentioned, they're unbeaten at the moment. They've just been in fantastic form. But you can never count out Papua New Guinea. We know they're always very competitive, always very strong. And, of course, celebrating their 50 years of independence, I'm sure that will be an added boost for them in the finals this morning.
So who are the key players for both sides, the potential match winners?
Yeah, absolutely. Vanuatu, I'll just talk about them first because, you know, they've been just in great form. There, as I mentioned earlier, Rachel Andrew, she's been fantastic. 222 runs already in this tournament, and she also has a wonderful record as far as the bowling effort is concerned. She had a hat-trick against the Cook Islands. And when she's in fine form, the Vanuatu side tend to follow her lead. Raylene Ova, she's been great as far as the bowling stats are concerned. Already 5 wickets in this tournament. Valenta Langiatu, Selina Solman and Vicky Mansale are some of the key players in this Vanuatu side. For PNG, of course, led ably by their captain, Brenda Tau. She's been fantastic for them. Konio Oala, 206 runs altogether in this tournament. She had a wonderful century in the first match. Poke Siaka with 8 wickets to her name in this tournament. And they'll be ably assisted by Naoni Vare and Brenda Tau. So, you know, we're talking about two heavyweights as far as women's cricket in the region is concerned. And so we're expecting a great matchup here in Suva.
So what is the condition of the wicket like? Who does it suit?
In terms of wickets, for Papua New Guinea, they've already taken 8 wickets in this tournament, Poke Siaka. But when you look at a team like Vanuatu, they're very well balanced as far as their batting order is concerned. They're very strong in that department. But when it comes to the wickets as well, there's so much firepower in this Vanuatu side with the likes of Vicky Mansale, Raylene Ova, who's been doing fantastic for them. As far as Papua New Guinea is concerned as well, they're similar in terms of their capacity as well to take wickets. And so it's going to be a really interesting matchup between these two teams.
Asinata, what have you made of the tournament as a whole? Are standards on the up?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's wonderful to have teams from Asia, like Japan and Indonesia. They bring their own style of cricket. And then you have the powerhouses here in the Pacific with Papua New Guinea and Vanuatu. It's been great to see the Solomon Islands, Cook Islands, as well as Fiji. And it's been great to see, you know, Philippines. First time for them to be participating in this tournament. This is the biggest tournament ever that's been hosted here in Suva, Fiji. It's been a wonderful tournament as far as lifting the profile as well of cricket here in Fiji. And I'm sure around the region as well, as we see from the performances of the teams here, with a lot of the players having played overseas as well, it's just sort of lifted the tournament as a whole.
Whichever team wins today, do you think they're capable of making it all the way to the T20 World Cup in England next year?
I hope so. I mean, Vanuatu did that they didn't qualify for the World Cup, but they went to the global qualifiers in 2023 when they won the title. And then they also beat Zimbabwe in that global qualifiers. So that was a real, you know, a moment to celebrate for them beating a team like Zimbabwe. I hope that we have an opportunity to have one of the teams from our region compete at the World Cup.
Asinata, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
That's Asinata Walingoto from the ICC TV commentary team covering the T20 World Cup qualifying event in Suva.
50 years ago, Papua New Guinea became an independent nation.
In a joint NBC and ABC Radio Australia production, One Country takes you back to that defining moment in history. Meet those who witnessed the birth of a nation and hear how the spirit of independence continues to shape Papua New Guinea today. From tradition to transformation, don't miss One Country, Tuesday at 1 p.m. and 6 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Hello and welcome back to Pacific Beat, live from Port Moresby, Papua New Guinea. As you may have heard from the top of the show, PNG is celebrating 50 years of independence. I'm joined by my co-host and our reporter from PNG, Belinda Cora, and our producer, Liam Fox. Firstly, Belinda, look, celebrations are already happening. I'd love to know, what has the atmosphere and preparation been like for this momentous occasion?
Yes, thanks, Aggie. Well, as you can or you have seen for yourself in the last couple of days, celebrations have already started since last month and have hyped up a little in the last couple of days, with more and more citizens joining in the celebrations in the capital and also in outside centres, with music festivals, air shows, SME markets, amazing tributes and also music, traditional music festivals as well, showcasing of PNG's first ever Aviation Heritage Centre, art and craft, including the arrival of Pacific leaders and Prince Edward, the Duke of Edinburgh also, who arrived just yesterday, also to join in on these celebrations.
Yeah, and it has been a last few days of just seeing sights and sounds here in PNG. But I'm going to bring in our producer, Liam. Liam, look, you're no stranger to PNG. I mean, what's it like being back here in PNG?
Yeah, I think from looking at my passport, it's been 5 years since I came to PNG. And I was here as the correspondent between 2009 and 2014. Moresby has changed a lot. There's a lot more big buildings.
Yeah.
Been a lot of development here, stadiums where our hotel looks over Sir John Guy Stadium and the soccer pitch and all the buildings, lots and lots of new buildings around. And it's been amazing to come back here after 5 years. And, yeah, as Belle said and as I mentioned in the story at the top of the show, there's really a lot of excitement, a lot of pride on the streets. Everywhere you look, there's either a Papua New Guinean flag or, you know, street vendors selling Papua New Guinean themed Mary blouses and T-shirts and hats and little flags. Yeah, it's a really nice feeling. In the capital.
Well, yeah, and I'm glad we're all here, basically being part of the celebrations for the 50th anniversary. I mean, Belinda, some of the stuff that we got to say, I'd love if you could share about what we got to see yesterday.
Oh, yes. We've not been able to see a spectacular flower and orchid show here in Port Moresby. We were able to see that from 20 women from the Highlands region who flew in by the Events Council. They're here in Port Moresby, and it was beautiful. Parliament was like just so colourful. The Parliament House was so colourful because they were able to also, you know, put up their stalls there. After that, we were able to go and see art and craft, you know, speak to one of the artists here at the Sir John Guy Stadium, where the National Cultural Commission is also showcasing close to 200 paintings and artifacts as well. And I should say everyone loves the Bird of Paradise. And I think that was my favorite part, apart from the walk around Nature Park.
That was a bit of a stretch of a walk, but it was beautiful to see what's on showcase. I mean, can I just get you, before I come to you again, Liam, are you aware of who is actually going to be attending the 50th celebrations leader-wise?
Yes, I understand that we will be expecting the Australian Prime Minister. We'll be also expecting a representative of the Indonesian government, also a rep from the New Zealand government as well. And also, I think we have some leaders from our Pacific Island Forum who have also come here to Port Moresby. They were here on the earlier flight, and they've already arrived. I think that's basically it for now.
Yeah. I think there's a couple of senior representatives also from Japan, India as well. The United States is sending Deputy Secretary of State, I believe.
Yeah.
We've got the Solomon Islands PM, Jeremiah Meneles here. I think Winston Peters, New Zealand's foreign minister, is coming later today as well. So, yeah, a big coterie of foreign leaders.
And of course, tomorrow is the actual day of, you know, independence for PNG. I know, could you just give us a bit of a brief, because you'll be out there at the flag raising, right, Liam?
Sure, sure. I'll be up nice and early. And the flag raising is 4 a.m., I believe. That's on Independence Hill, which is just next to the Parliament House. And we saw the band practicing yesterday. People standing in practice salutes for that as well. So that should be really moving ceremony, you know, in the pre-dawn light. So that's kicks off tomorrow. That's a flag raising. Then there's going to be a flag lowering, which is a commemoration of what happened 50 years ago when the Australian flag was lowered. And all those leaders that we just talked about will be there. And then the night is going to be capped off. There are a range of events happening during the day as well. There's a big choir lining along the streets, bells, is that right? And then it'll all be capped off by what they're calling the PNG Spectacular, which is a big show at Sir John Guy Stadium. I could actually see them practicing last night from my hotel room. That has been described as a show that's going to show the history of PNG and where it's going in the future. And all those leaders will once again be there, as well as locals. And then a fireworks spectacular to cap it all off. So big day tomorrow.
Nice. But, Bells, what can we sort of expect in the next few days? Is there any other stories that we're looking at?
Oh, yes. I think we would be, you know, glad to, you know, continue talking to a lot of people on our streets, you know, apart from coming and turning up for these events right throughout the country, not only in Port Moresby. What are they feeling? What are their hopes? What are their concerns? What are their dreams of for the next 50 years? And I think that's a very important talk around town, which is not even spoken of, because everyone is actually, you know, in a very prideful moment, and we'll continue to, you know, check on them for the next couple of days as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the sights, the sounds, and the colour here from PNG, and we're so happy that we get to be here on the ground bringing you the latest with the 50th anniversary of independence for PNG. So we'll be heading out to just for a little bit of a break, but we'll come back very shortly.
Countless aircraft were shot down over Papua New Guinea during the Second World War. Many of them are now valued cultural artifacts for local and landowners. However, they're also highly valuable for overseas collectors, as landowners in Oro Province learned in 2006 when her famed World War II bomber was salvaged and removed from their land without compensation. Now, after 20 years, the campaign is underway to have it returned to what should have been its final resting place. Kyle Evans reports.
Provisional landowner Ian Jagiro chuckles when he tells the story today, but his grandfather wasn't laughing when a B-17 bomber crash-landed a short distance from his village during the Second World War.
It was, you know, that time it was in the war, and they were, you know, scared, and they were hiding, and that plane just, you know, landed in their, you know, land.
The plane crashed not too far from the Kokoda Track in 1942 in Papua New Guinea's Oro Province. For years, it captivated locals, as well as Australian soldiers who nicknamed it the Swamp Ghost, after spotting the plane whilst on a training exercise in 1972.
When we were, you know, growing up, they used to, you know, tell stories about that plane. And we usually go, you know, see that plane. Sometimes we really wanted to, you know, just go around and see the, you know, plane relic. It was untouched. It was there.
Private collectors, however, saw dollar signs. Efforts to salvage Swamp Ghost began in the 80s. Then in 2006, a permit was issued to an Australian, Robert Greinert. He had a reputation for this sort of work. In fact, a parliamentary inquiry estimated he's taken 24 aircraft from PNG at an estimated value of $20 million. Swamp Ghost became one of them.
They came in aggressive. They don't want, you know, landowners or, you know, surrounding villages to, you know, come and buy and, you know, look what they were doing. They just, you know, took it off.
By law, war wrecks are the property of the landowner on which it rests, as well as the PNG government. Each are entitled to compensation if relics are removed by overseas salvors. Yet somehow a deal was struck to ship the swamp ghost to the US, and landowners, like Mr. Jijiro, say they never received a cent.
They promised that funding would be divided among state, provincial government, and landowners. And nothing happened. That's why I really wanted the swamp ghost to be back in the province of Papua New Guinea.
By the time Australian documentary crew 60 Minutes heard about it in 2015, the plane was on display in the Pearl Harbor Aviation Museum in Hawaii.
I know that you don't want to do an interview, but there are very serious allegations that we want to put to you.
There are some very serious allegations about your behaviour as well.
Where have all the planes gone, Mr. Greinert?
That was 10 years ago. Now a fresh push is underway to have the swamp ghost returned to PNG, 20 years after it was taken.
I'm working on how we can bring that plane back, because that property is the property of Papua New Guinea.
That's Ora Province Governor Gary Juffa.
However, it was taken across there by an Australian character who basically came in and identified all these World War II aircraft, and then he found ways to ship them across abroad.
Governor Juffa remembers the swamp ghost all too well. He was Commissioner of Customs when the plane was salvaged.
An NEC decision was put together by politicians who said, no, it's okay because we'll get a replica plane. That replica plane hasn't arrived.
Last month, Governor Juffa penned a letter to PNG's US ambassador in hopes of getting the process started. In the meantime, he hopes to look at ways to strengthen laws to ensure landowners don't get hoodwinked by overseas treasure hunters, many of whom are contractors who help governments like the US and New Zealand find wrecks and repatriate remains. Justin Talon from Pacific Wrecks is one of them. He says the industry is a bit like the Wild West.
There are people all over the world willing to bend and break rules to acquire these aircraft at any price. They're worth millions of dollars.
That was Justin Talon from Pacific Wrecks, ending that report by Kyle Evans, and Robert Greinert had also been approached for comment.
Well, it's been just over 2 months since the International Court of Justice handed down its landmark advisory opinion on climate change, ruling that states do have an obligation to protect the environment from greenhouse gas emissions. But as the Pacific countries wait to see how this advisory opinion will influence climate change action, some questions on how effective high-level campaigns and talks are. But Tuvalu's High Commissioner to Fiji, Dr. Esia Alofa Abinelu, who is also Tuvalu's former Attorney General, argues that advisory opinions offer the region and clear guidance on the way forward. Dr. Abinelu spoke to our reporter, Jordan Fennell.
I think for Tuvalu, it's not only the advisory opinion from the ICJ, but prior to the ICJ, there was an advisory opinion from the International Tribunal for Law of the Sea, which actually addressed issues, similar issues, under the Convention on the Law of the Sea, UNCLOS, which basically rules everything about the ocean, and we are ocean states, and anything that clarifies what our obligations are and what duties of the member states and not members in making sure that the climate is kept healthy for our future generation are very welcoming. Yes, yeah, so for us, for Tuvalu, the advisory opinions are very positive. They have provided a very positive outcome for countries like us in furthering strategies that we can attend to with the international community.
What do advisory opinions give Pacific nations that big climate talks like the COP, Conference of Parties talks, can't give Pacific nations? What's that difference between the benefit of an advisory opinion as opposed to huge global stage talks?
I think part of the question whether advisory opinions would become the norm in the future. Because with advisory opinions, at least we know their certainty. There will be a decision at the end of the opinion. The courts will have to provide opinion, and then it's up to member states to make use of the advisory opinion. Whereas with the other discussions, COP, there's no certainty at the end of the discussion. And I think that's also part of the strategy why we had to go to the courts in the first place. I think before the advisory opinion from the ICJ was delivered, the COSIS, that's a commissioner of small island states on climate change and international law, which Tuvalu and Antigua and Barbuda formed. And then also COSIS was they brought the first case before the ECLOS, questioning that the various similar issues that were also brought up in the Vanuatu-led advisory opinion that came out in the ICJ. I think it all came out with from the frustrations of the talks. Well, I think we, a small island country that are really affected by climate change, we want action. We want to see where we are and how we'll be protected. So sitting back and reflecting on the UN system and international law, we realize that, you know, we have these pinnacle bodies, legal bodies at the UN that have just been sitting there and they haven't shared what they think. And we are discussing the law and we haven't even asked the experts to give their views on the law. So we took the cases to them and asked them, please explain to us what do these international conventions really mean for member states. And so they have delivered and they have become very helpful advisory opinions for most member countries.
On the question that you raised, will advisory opinions become the norm in terms of how perhaps small island states will fight for climate change action? Personally, do you think they will become the norm?
Personally, I think it might. And I'm also hoping that it may be further utilized because at least it brings clear guidance because the court will facilitate what it is that our challenge is. You take it to the court for their views and their opinion before getting to the consensus cases before the court. So it provides a leeway for member countries, I believe, or people who are concerned by climate change to use it as an alternative route to the continuing discussions without knowing what the outcomes would be. Advisory opinions, I think they are more certain. At the end of the day, you probably have a fair idea how the courts will be interpreting the provisions of the existing laws that he had.
What do you think that means then for Tuvalu and the next generation who are looking forward to their fight against climate change?
I think the advisory opinion is my personal opinion. It has provided a very good platform for people and for member states to reassess what we are doing now and strategize the way forward because certain areas have been clarified by the courts without stepping on influencing states' sovereignty and stuff. Knowing what the courts have said, I think it allows people now taking the issues forward to know what are the issues that need to be discussed properly with responsible states or instead of becoming too confrontational.
And that was Tuvalu's High Commissioner to Fiji, Dr. Abinelu, speaking to reporter Jordan Fennell. Well, that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Thank you so much for joining us on our first day of broadcast here in PNG.
And you can join us again tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time and also listen again in for more updates at 5 p.m. again, I think PNG time as well.
Absolutely. Yes. So stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because your news is next. And coming up after that, it's Nisha Daily. So until next time, Odua Afaatu, thank you so much for joining me and Belinda Cora here on Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.